You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027. This is Classic Business with Michael Avery.
Cool. Tobacco is a dirty business. Powerful lobbies, links to locally state capture have been laid bare in various exposés by Jacques Poe and the President's Keepers, Johan van Lochrenberg in Tobacco Wars, and most recently, and also at a global level, by Talita Snickers in Dirty Tobacco. Now, the President tried to snub out the growing speculation about the real reasons behind the continued ban on the sale of tobacco products after Cooperative Governance Minister Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma relayed that the Command Council had debated and decided not to lift the ban the President had said just a few days earlier would be lifted. And since then, we've just seen skepticism and anger grow in the absence of rational explanations. It's an environment mired in legal battles where the absence of licit smokes has caused suspicion of deeper, insidious fires to rage. So what is going on here? Let's welcome our panelists to find out. A policeman by experience and lawyer by training, Johan van Lochrenberg is probably best known for heading the ill-fated South African Revenue Service's high-level investigative unit, and he's the author of two explosive books, Rogue, The Inside Story and Tobacco Wars, and is furiously working away on his third, I believe. So thanks for joining us, Johan. And also on the line, we've got a former SARS lawyer and advisor to the International Monetary Fund on illicit trade flows, Talita Snickers, who's in Asia somewhere. Welcome, Talita, and likewise, congratulations on your new book, Tobacco, Dirty Tobacco, I should say, and it's really quite riveting. But Johan, kick us off here, because writing in Rogue with Adrian Lackey, you stated in Chapter 11 that the tobacco industry in South Africa is a dirty business. It's a case study in business interests, organized crime, and influence over state officials, and all of those overlap. And through Project Honey Badger, you've got vast experience studying this industry. Just share what makes it so dirty.
Where to begin? I think one should perhaps look at an overview of the last, say, 25 years. In the late 90s, the multinational tobacco manufacturers dominated the South African market, and that was by and large slowly over time diminished with the mushrooming and coming up of smaller manufacturers in South Africa who began to sell cheaper brands of cigarettes. I've now got one of those situations where the little kid runs into the room.
It was bound to happen at some stage, no problem. I'm sure they've become quite expert in this area as well. Talita, you've also got young ones homeschooling at the moment. It is quite a challenge.
It happens.
Net effect of that is that, in short, is that the big multinationals had to begin to counter the, you know, their competitors, and they managed to get their claws into different parts of the state in different ways, and by doing so began to direct the law enforcement efforts and revenue service efforts to their advantage. And of course, the smaller players weren't averse to breaking the law during those years, and as a consequence out of that came so many dirty dynamics, dirty tricks, spying on each other, misinformation, disinformation, controlling the sort of public perception and narrative of cigarettes. And I think that at a high level would describe what's caused the fuss.
And Talita, in your book, you reveal that illegally trafficked cigarettes, illicit tobacco, is more profitable than cocaine, heroin, marijuana, or guns. Just share why it's such a profitable and flourishing enterprise.
Well, you know, for a number of reasons. So if you were to smuggle heroin, you would make 1,800% profit on average. For illicit tobacco, the profit margin stands at around 4,200%. And, you need to remember our customs agencies also on average tend to scan somewhere between 3 and 5% of containers, which means it's extremely easy to smuggle tobacco. And because it is largely illicit legal product, even if you do get caught with illicit cigarettes, you don't lose your assets. You don't get sent to prison. So it's easy to smuggle. Drug dogs can't, you know, sniff out an illicit pack of cigarettes. And it is simply, it's just incredibly profitable. And as we see now with the lockdown, people are willing to pay an inordinate amount of money to get their hands on cigarettes.
And I think what dirty tobacco shows is the true scale of dirty tobacco globally. This is not a South African phenomenon. In fact, your book really takes a global view. You talk about China. You have a look at what's going on in the US. It appears there's a playbook here. What is that playbook that's being used predominantly by big tobacco?
Well, so initially I was astonished at the extent to which big tobacco companies, so multinational tobacco companies, were involved in tobacco smuggling. So for instance, you mentioned China. So at some point, 25% of BAT's profits came from smuggling into China. And it's a pattern that's repeated itself, you know, through the 70s, right until last year, this year, there were still examples of big tobacco smuggling. And so when you start unpacking how they do their business, it becomes apparent that they've developed this, what I call a playbook. And so what they do is four things. The first one is that they control what we think about the tobacco industry because they control what we read. The second part of their playbook is that they control our politicians, and they either do this, you know, using gold and chains with gifts and, you know, beautiful words, or if that fails, you know, with blackmail. And then the third part of their playbook is that they control law enforcement agencies. So they control where our law enforcement agencies look, and they control where our law enforcement agencies don't look. And then the fourth part of their playbook that they've absolutely mastered turns on making sure that their downstream supply chain stays completely opaque. In other words, once a pack leaves their factory, we have no way of tracing it back to them. And that's why they manage to get away with supplying the black market to the extent that they do.
And that's an important point. In your book, you actually talk about how toothpaste has a more secure supply chain, and we'll come back to that. Johan, from your experience, how has big tobacco controlled what the public reads and what the media portrays about big tobacco?
Well, I mean, first of all, they've been around for so long. You know, most of them have histories dating back centuries. They are massive companies listed worldwide on almost all the stock exchanges in the world. And there has always been a natural assumption that big businesses that have been around for so long are trustworthy. And, you know, governments invest in shares in these big companies. The PIC in South Africa holds significant values in shares in British American Tobacco, for instance. So they that's the thing that's always been leveraged off. In the South African context, how I found them to do this would be simple examples, like in the early 2000s, spokespeople on behalf of someone like British American Tobacco expressing views to the media about how uninformed colored people are in South Africa, by way of example, because of their inability to distinguish between legitimate and counterfeit cigarettes. That's the level of arrogance and there's the subtle racism that was not even questioned publicly. Later on came the sort of broader and more direct attack on local competitors through predominantly a body that existed of which they were all members, known as the Tobacco Institute of Southern Africa, which kept on messaging how illicit tobacco was somehow connected to terrorism worldwide, the funding of child trafficking and human trafficking rings, it somehow funded, illegal drugs and firearm smuggling and things like that. And there was this sort of almost direct tainting of, these brands of the local manufacturers by direct association with other ills in society. And then it became even more subtle but more sophisticated in the publication of a research report by a credible research outfit, Ipsos, where first of all they try to demonstrate to South Africans how large the illicit market was and what a threat this was to the tax base and to the legitimate industry, and then they highlighted all sorts of brands that they considered to be illicit. And they played in this sort of semantical space of, to the common reader, well, if you buy this sort of brand of cigarette, it's an illicit brand, which is not true. But there's no explanation what renders a packet of cigarettes illicit to begin with. So those would be the sort of examples of controlling the narrative.
And Talita, in your book, you say that there's no legal liability in terms of know your customer, KYC, and that the illicit market that everybody confuses with the counterfeit cigarette and small operators is a clear strategy. You say that big tobacco is actually exaggerating the impact of illicit tobacco. Why would they be doing this?
It's a really interesting conversation. So big tobacco, tobacco industry overall actually, has obviously been losing smokers. And one of the reasons they've been losing smokers is because governments are hiking the tax rates on packets of cigarettes. And of course, as tax rates are hiked, the cigarettes become less affordable. And so in theory, fewer people smoke, and certainly fewer people smoke expensive packs of cigarettes. So what big tobacco has started doing, and there are multiple examples of this happening all over the world, including South Africa, is they would argue that illicit trade exists only because tax rates are too high. So for them, it makes for a very nice policy statement that if government were to reduce tax rates, or at the very least not increase tax rates, it would make sure that the illicit market wouldn't grow. So that's the argument that they advance. But in fact, it's a simple ploy to get governments not to increase tax rates as a way for them to keep the prices down and to keep more smokers smoking more expensive brands.
Absolutely, to keep them profitable, which initially seems counterintuitive, but you can understand exactly what the strategy is behind that. Now, a big part of this is understanding the supply chain, understanding how cigarettes are supposedly exported. Many of them go missing along the way. They don't end up at their ports of entry from the receiving countryside. So we know that something is going wrong. In your book, I mentioned you talk about how toothpaste has actually got a more secure supply chain. What do we mean by supply chain management when it comes to cigarettes and manufacturing of tobacco products? And what do we mean by regulating it within the context of the Global Tobacco Protocol?
Right. So the World Health Organization has the Framework Control on Tobacco Control and Framework Convention, on Tobacco Control. And it specifies a number of good practice measures that countries should implement to better control the tobacco supply chain. And it includes measures around things like know your customer, around commensurate demand. So don't sell more cigarettes into a market than there are consumers for it, at a high level. But really what it boils down to is when a tobacco company makes a batch of cigarettes, the first thing we need to do is to have production controls so that we actually know how many cigarettes they've produced. And we need to know how many of those cigarettes were produced for the local market and how many of those were produced for export. Because if they exported, then, of course, you don't need to pay excise duties and VAT on them. Then as the cigarettes leave the tobacco factory, we need to be able to trace them through the supply chain so that we can make sure that they end up where they were supposed to go. So if a tobacco manufacturer declares, I am making for the local market, we need to make sure that those cigarettes actually stay on the local market. If they declare that, you know, 10 packs were destined for another country, we need to know for a fact that the packs actually left the country. But what we also need to do, whether you're a customs officer or a police officer, if you go to a supermarket or to a spaza shop or you buy a pack of cigarettes off one of these new WhatsApp groups, you need to be able to trace a cigarette back, a pack, back to the manufacturer where it originally came from. Right now in South Africa, we can't do any of those things. So if you, for instance, look at the purported exports from South Africa in terms of cigarettes, we know that a company like BAT says that they export to 22 countries from the volumes that they manufacture in the country. And when we look at the exports that leave South Africa, 66% of them go missing. So they never get to the country that they are destined for. So if they're not getting to the country they're destined for, that suggests that, they're being diverted, that the supply chain has leakage somewhere along the lines. If they are not getting to the countries where they are destined, that probably means that those packs are still in South Africa somewhere and should be taxed, but they're not. And so SARS hasn't introduced any of the proper supply chain measures that we need, firstly, to know exactly how many cigarettes are being produced, and secondly, to trace cigarettes back to a manufacturer if we find a pack on the market.
What about inviting SARS to post custom officials at all the cigarette factories to prevent undeclared cigarettes from entering the market?
There was actually a stage where that was a practice. It's very much discouraged from an international policy perspective because we know that the minute you have manual human intervention, you end up with really big integrity risks. You know, this is a you know, business that makes huge profits. Even if we seized 9 out of 10 illicit containers, they would still be making profits. The profit on an illicit container sits at more than $2 million. So to post a customs officer who earns, you know, a respectable salary, but certainly not an inordinate amount of money, the integrity risks are simply too big. And so from a policy perspective, that isn't something that you would choose as a first, you know, cause of action.
What is better then, to more accurately sort of track and trace? I think track and trace has really got into the public lexicon thanks to COVID-19, but we're talking about tracking and tracing cigarettes here.
Well, so track and trace in South Africa actually has a pretty interesting history. So way back in 2007, SARS indicated that they wanted to introduce the ability to track and trace cigarette packs through the supply chain. They again committed to introduce track and trace in 2010 and 2013 and 2015. And every time something seems to have derailed the introduction of track and trace. We know that for the longest time, the Tobacco Institute of Southern Africa had a very close relationship with officials at SARS. We also know that when SARS published a track and trace tender last year, TISA was very vocally opposed to the introduction of track and trace measures. Whereas FITA, the organization representing the more independent organizations, was actually very supportive of the introduction of track and trace. So you have to wonder why an organization like TISA, who represents companies like BAT, was so opposed to introducing track and trace.
One has to start connecting those dots. And Johan, there is a lot of speculative dot connecting that's going on at the moment on the back of the COGTA minister's decision to hold on to the tobacco sale ban. And the rumor and speculation is that it's because it suits people like Adriano Mazzotti, who is the proprietor of Carney Links and other of the FITA members. Is there any truth to that rumor from any of the research that you've done?
Michael, I think I should say the following. The fact that politics Influence in governments and cigarettes are a toxic mix. Is a fact of the matter the world over, and I think you can see that in particular if you read Delito's book, Dirty Tobacco. And it's been the case ever since cigarettes have been around. That there was some interaction between Minister Dlamini Zuma and Mr. Mazzotti, I don't think either have denied that. Beyond that, I would not speculate. The tobacco industry is renowned for the dirty tricks, misinformation and disinformation, and I don't think it's helpful to feed into that sort of space. Until we see facts to the contrary, one should give people the benefit of the doubt. I agree with Delito. You know, the brands do tell a story, and the fact that you can buy every single brand, you know, multinational or small player currently under lockdown in South Africa, you know, gives you an indication that none of the tobacco manufacturers can claim to be clean and you know, have no skeletons in their closet. It's a matter of scale and loss to the fiscus and methodology. And I should just add lastly that the manner in which the crimes manifest in the tobacco sector is not so unique to the cigarette and tobacco trade. The scams are common across all economic sectors where there are consumable products. What makes it so lucrative, I think, and why companies get involved in this at all levels is precisely because of the low cost factor and the high and ever increasing excise consequence attached to that. And the fact that if you do get bust, the music that you face is kind of not so bad. You know, it's really low risk, high rewards that they all face. And I think in the debate around, you know, the big multinationals versus the smaller players, ultimately one has to weigh up things like scale, quantify the losses, and the nature of and the sophistication of the scams. So local companies can really only smuggle or manufacture in an unrecorded fashion, whereas the bigger multinationals have far more sophisticated schemes, like very aggressive profit shifting, intercompany trades, and so on. So it's not an your fruit basket is not just apples, and that's probably the biggest mistake I think people make.
Yeah, and I think, Talisa, what you show in the book is certainly how big tobacco has been caught red-handed. Very well-known international examples of this, British American Tobacco Chief among them. As you've just indicated, over 60% of exports don't end up at their country of destination. So where are they going? And they control roughly three quarters of the South African market. It doesn't stop the speculation, though, Talisa, because we know that there are well-established links that and you've interviewed Adriano Mazzotti between himself and EFF Supremo Julius Malema. We had the EFF releasing a statement objecting to the sale of tobacco products on the same day as the ANC Women's League did. And it's beyond sheer coincidence, surely, that old allies suddenly converge around the benefits of a cigarette ban out of pure public health concerns. But I want to move on to those public health concerns. Let's talk about facts and strip away the speculation, Talita. In terms of what the South African government has put forward as a rationale for the continued ban on the sale of tobacco products, I've yet to see anything that holds up in the realm of rational scientific reasoning and logic to continue the ban on the sale of tobacco products. Have you?
No. You know, so I did a bit of digging in the Disaster Management Act to really understand what kind of discretions government actually has when it comes to introducing bans like this. And so what we know is that the DMA actually gives the minister some interesting powers when it comes to alcohol, but it didn't specify anything in respect of tobacco, right? And so what that means is that government has exercised an administrative discretion, a constitutional discretion. And whenever you exercise a constitutional discretion or administrative discretion, I think there are a number of prerequisites, and you need to, you know, be rational. You need to have a regulation that is rationally related to the objective that you are trying to achieve. And I think that's important. And then the third prerequisite is that there mustn't be other suitable alternatives that could let you achieve the same objective. Now, you know, I think when you look at government's explanations or lack thereof, I don't think, firstly, that they can argue that it is rationally connected to the objective that they wish to achieve. And I certainly think that they don't pass the test of there not being other, you know, less infringing regulations that they could have introduced. So I know that, you know, FITA was expecting to get government's response yesterday in terms of the reasons why they're continuing with the ban on tobacco. I saw they issued a press release today that they will be continuing with the court challenge. And what that tells me is very simply that whatever these reasons are that government had given them were not sufficient. And as I'm not convinced, clearly FITA wasn't convinced either that they've passed constitutional muster on the responses that they've provided.
And as we know, the decision to release some of the minutes from that meeting have been refused up to this point as well, which just adds further fuel to the speculative fire. Johan, as we wrap up our time together, and we could probably spend the next couple of hours talking about the various elements of the tobacco industry, the links that it has to state intelligence agencies, the moles, the spies, it's all there. It's like a John Grisham novel. It really is. But the upshot to all of this is for ordinary South Africans, for taxpayers, what is the extent of the loss to the fiscus? What is the cost of all of this? And in closing, what needs to be done to remedy this situation?
I think in a general sense, the portion of the total trade in cigarettes and tobacco in South Africa in the early 2000s up to the mid-2000s were about 10% of the total market. That shot up to 2012 to somewhere in the just near the 20%. The Revenue Service then introduced a very clever project called Honey Badger that looked across the value chain at a number of parts of the value chain and the different tax types, different tax schemes, and different taxpayers across the board. That managed to turn the curve, plateaued out, and even reduce the market down to the sort of lower tens. Then came state capture, the Revenue Service, and almost within a matter of 1 year, the portion of the market shot up to, that's illicit, shot up to almost 30%, and in some studies show even higher, closer to half the market. You're talking about a revenue take of around 15 billion rand per annum. The value of the total sector is somewhere around 30 billion per annum. Currently under lockdown, that's roughly what's being lost to the fiscus per month, is about a billion rand with a B. And what should be done is, I think the principles around Project Honey Badger should be revisited. I think it shows on the numbers that it was very effective. It consisted of a ridiculously low number of Revenue Service officials fighting that war on their own, whilst also having to fend off all sorts of attacks from different quarters. And lastly, I think we should never ever allow a situation where people employed by particularly these multinationals fool us in a way that they ultimately laid the path for the state capture gang to formulate what became known as the road unit narrative and actively participated and helped it along. You know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We can go back to what worked and put it back into place.
When you left SARS back in 2015, that Project Honey Badger was culminating in, I think, 15 different criminal cases against tobacco manufacturers and importers. It should have netted the fiscus 3 billion rand in that financial year alone. At a time when we're scratching around for revenue, it's clear where some of the low-hanging fruit lie. If we've got the political will, unfortunately, we have run out of time. We don't have any more time left to go into whether or not the cases can be revived. I'm sure they can, though. Johan, thank you very much for your time. And Talita, to you too. The book Dirty Tobacco, Spies, Lies and Mega Profits adds to this growing body of evidence and adds further pressure on the investigating and prosecuting agencies just to do something when there's so much prima facie illegal activity that's denying South Africans schools and clinics and roads and a better future. So thanks both to you, to your time and for your efforts and for your courage in pursuing these investigations without fear or favor. Take care.
This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Johannesburg and Fine Music Radio in Cape Town.
Well, that's a wrap from the team tonight. I'll leave you in the hands of Maestro Richard Koch in Joburg and Keir Netze to warm you up in Cape Town. Good night.